The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. Phil Foden has fun against as opposed to in Iceland as he scores twice in a 4-0 win. What does it mean? 3-4-3 is good? You don't need two holding midfielders? Or simply England can beat teams who aren't as good as them? And why are we talking about them when Wales are the story? Winning their Nations League group as Daniel James scores a cracker. In shock news, Ireland failed to score. Will they ever score a goal again? Elsewhere, Norway B get a point, Giroud gets closer to Henry's record, and Germany get absolutely walloped by Spain. There's controversy in the AFCON qualifiers, lots of injuries, a Premier League preview, your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Flo Lloyd-Hughes, hello.
Hello, Max.
Barry Glendenning, hello.
Hi.
Philippe Auclair, bonjour, ça va?
Bonjour, ça va?
Ça va bien. S. Hart says, what are we going to do between now and March without any international football? Absolutely no idea. But let's begin with England's demolition of Iceland. Andy says, where are we going to put football when we bring it home? It was a 4-0 victory. Let's start, shall we, with Phil Foden's performance. Adam says, are you, as an influential, award-winning podcast, going to fully endorse the clear truth that Grealish's time has come and gone and Foden is the new messiah, or are you going to live in the past? Luke, I assume we're building the England team around Foden now. Was Grealish's stint as the man to build the team around the shortest ever? I don't know what you take from this game, Philippe, apart from, you know, England are better than Iceland, but it was nice to see.
Well, we take 3 points, Max. They're absolutely of no use to anyone, yeah. But we take 3 points.
But you know, we were good. Foden was good. Yeah. Grealish was good. Saka was. It was a nice performance.
Yeah, and Iceland were not very good. Looking their age, I think quite a few of them. Proving a little bit difficult to find the successors to this wonderful teams of the wonderful team of the 2010s. No, I don't think there's much you can say. Interesting use of Harry Maguire, perhaps, against this kind of packed up defenses when he does basically what Guardiola's fullbacks do against other teams, which means they turn up in midfield, except that he's a centre back and there was no midfield because they played in one half. So basically, I've really got absolutely nothing to say about this game. Yes, Phil Foden was excellent.
Yeah, I liked Harry Maguire at left wing. Gaz said, you know, it's Maguire doing the opposite of Rooney and most professional footballers and going further up the pitch as he gets older.
But there was obviously a plan there because he kept doing the same ball over and over again, so which was this big 50-yard cross-field pass towards Kieran Trippier. And amazingly enough, a few of them actually found Trippier. It was wonderful. I mean, what else can you say?
Philippe, to be honest, Philippe, I feel it's Barry's job when I talk about football matches to look at me and say, I've got nothing to say about that game. I'm not sure that's territory you should be standing on. Barry, you have a go then.
Well, if you look past the fact that it was a monumental waste of everyone's time that almost certainly shouldn't have been played, it was played to fulfill a contractual obligation with a television company. I thought, and the fact that Iceland were absolutely diabolically bad, even before they got reduced to 10 men quite early in the game. And, you know, what's happened to them, that's a story for another day, because it's not so long ago, every newspaper in the UK was running these lengthy features about this revolution in Icelandic football and how they were going to take over the world because they'd built some indoor pitches. That's worked out well for them. I thought what England can take for this is the players look like they were enjoying themselves on an evening when they could be forgiven for just, you know, going through the motions. And it's often long been a case that English players give the impression that they're not enjoying themselves at all and would rather be anywhere else than playing for England. These players seem to want to play for England, which hasn't always been the case. And a lot of them played very well. It was quite exciting. Again, the opposition, it was like they were up against training cones at some points. But my worry is that these players won't actually, well, a lot of these players won't start for England at the Euros, and Gareth Southgate will put on his belt and put on his braces, and it won't be as exciting. But yeah, it was a monumental waste of time, but I quite enjoyed it as monumental waste of time go.
A belt and braces, Jordan Henderson and Declan Rice, Barry.
Well, I feel kind of sorry for Jordan Henderson, because I watched the game and I enjoyed it so much. I watched it again on the highlights this morning just to see if there was any nuances I missed. And on the highlights, they were discussing, as everyone does, Gareth Southgate's formation. And, you know, he quite rightfully picked six defenders against this cutting-edge Icelandic attack. You can't be too careful. I'm surprised he didn't have another one in there, you know, instead of Mason Mount. On ITV, Roy Keane, Ian Wright and Mark Pugach were going through various possible England formations, and poor old Jordan Henderson didn't feature in any of them. So if I was him and I'd been watching, I'd have felt slightly miffed.
England now has the weapons, I think, to deal with teams which would defend quite far back. But the other thing is also, when we talk about the players, it's also the way these players are programmed to perform in that England team, regardless of the tactical situation. I mean, for example, a player like Declan Rice, and I know I've got a thing about Declan Rice, because it really irritates me to see him pass the ball behind his partners. He's very safe in his passing. And I think he's better than that, honestly. But there is something infuriating about the fact that even against Iceland, if you look at it, the first 30 minutes in particular, every single one of his passes was either lateral or backwards. And not only that, it was not, in what the French we say, dans le sens de la course, as in you anticipate the player to run and this is where you put the ball. And the same went as well for the centre-halves and even for Kyle Walker up to, which is, you know, when you think of the Walker we see with Man City, is incredible. But there is a tendency of playing it so safe and so slow. And, you know, the fact that it really got better after a while, after 30 minutes, and we saw some actually lovely football with Mount in particular, I thought was absolutely wonderful, shouldn't disguise the fact that, again, and maybe, yes, it's a game which is of no import, it was very ponderous to start with. Very, very ponderous. And the reason for that was not because of the players or the tactical system. It was simply because of a frame of mind, which is safety first in the way you transmit the ball. Now, that can work. It works for France, for example. Should it work for England? I don't think that's the best solution. But again, the psychological setup is not entirely of Gareth Southgate's making. It's a heritage. It's a legacy of years and years and decades of a certain way of apprehending the game and actually failing quite well sometimes, but failing.
Richard Jolly says, Declan Rice, the first player, excluding own goals, who scored for England after playing international football for another country since Gordon Hodgson in 1930. And Lloyd says, what's the least aware you've ever been of a team you support playing a match? Mine's tonight when I got a first goal alert through for England. I had absolutely no idea that they were playing today. Anyway, we'll move on from England. James says, reckon you might give Wales more than 15 seconds this time, seeing as they're the only home nation to actually achieve anything in the Nations League. I do remember once on the pod, Baz, trying to play the countdown music and then not being allowed to use it. That was before we knew all we'd have to do is review the tune to be allowed to play it. Hey, listen, what another good win for Wales. Been a really good Nations League for them. They played 6, won 5, drawn 1. Pretty efficient 4-7 against 1. 11 games unbeaten, their longest run. No Ramsey, also missing Ben Davis, Joe Allen, Wayne Hennessy. Ryan Giggs wasn't there either. I mean, this game was decided on a not entirely, but the sending off after 11 minutes makes quite a big difference. Gerry Aronin sent off for pulling down Harry Wilson after 12 minutes.
Sorry, but I'd just like to apologize. There's a man standing on some scaffolding outside my window, hammering. Oh, okay. I'm not sure if it's coming through.
Can he pick an England 11?
I could ask him.
Could you go and ask him?
Yeah, okay. Hold on a second. Right, I'll just see if I can get him in shot here. Hiya. Sorry, I'm just doing a football podcast here. Could we have your England 11 for the Euros? Any strong opinions?
Not particular.
No.
No,
they're roofing specialists, no interest in football.
Great shame. It was nice to see Barry. You know, that was, I reckon that's the, that's as close to investigative journalism as Barry has ever done. anyway, Philippe, that Daniel James strike was glorious, wasn't it?
It was absolutely magnificent, yes. He does deal in spectacular goals, doesn't he, young Danny James? And but again, yes, a very encouraging performance and in a pretty amazing series of results, because I think looking at it, they basically have become kind of unbeatable at home and haven't lost since 2018 now at home. And otherwise, scoring more goals than perhaps expected. But on the other hand, the 15 seconds have long elapsed. And we shouldn't go pretending that we know anything about Welsh football in my case. So I think I'll stop to that. And it was a lovely goal.
Yeah.
And it was a lovely goal. And well done to them for qualifying. And also, because of that and because of these excellent results, Wales are now in the second pot for the seedings for the World Cup qualifiers. And which is pretty decent, yeah, isn't it?
Makes a big difference. And if you win your Nations League group, it gives you Scotland got through to the Euros, right? If you win this group, and it gives you another chance to qualify for the World Cup. And it's been a while since Wales were at a World Cup.
Another pathway, I think, is what John King would
another
say.
Another pathway, you're right. And Danny James cross and his run and cross for Kiefer Moore was brilliant. I was listening to Kevin Ratcliffe giving Joe Morell some praise. He was on loan at Lincoln when he got called up for Wales, and his mum heard about the call up when Joe was on the team coach. Love the idea of a son, I ring him once every couple of weeks. Any news? No news. I've been called up for my country.
I think one of my main takeouts from this game was that Finland had a left back called Daniel O'Shaughnessy.
another one has slipped through, Baz.
Yeah.
He was born in Finland of an Irish father and a Finnish mother, but he's lived all his life in Finland, I believe.
Yeah, his father's from Galway and moved to Finland for love.
Would you move to Finland for love, Barry?
Well, I've never been to Finland, so I probably not, no.
And Harry Wilson's goal as well was lovely, but from a lovely Gareth Bale pass, so well done to Wales. Their Euros group, Italy, Switzerland and Turkey, is tough, but not impossible to get through that Euros group, do you think?
That's doable. That's definitely doable. I think Wales have got into the rhythm now of qualifying for tournaments. They've got a decent squad. I think the issue is Ryan Giggs, not only the situation going on with him off the pitch, but also the fact I don't think people are really convinced about him as a manager and him, I guess, being able to take Wales to that next stage, which is where they got to in the last Euros, which is, you know, going deep into tournaments. I don't think the expectations are that high for him as the head coach of Wales. That's the only thing, because some of the results, not last night, but some of the other results haven't been the most convincing or impressive displays, given some of the talents that they have as well. So it's a bit like England in that sense, that it is a really great generation for them, and it's about, now that they're getting to the knack of qualifying, how much further than can they push at that? Because fans are going to expect more. And I think it's great to have, you know, a famous Welsh face leading them. But as a coach, I don't think people have been that convinced by his talents.
I think that's a bit harsh. I mean, they're unbeaten in 11. And that's, for Wales, that is quite good, isn't it? They've only conceded one in the Nations League.
Yeah, but I think the expectations are much higher now. I think the expectations are much higher, and that they expect and want more. So, yeah, the unbeaten run is fantastic. I would say look at who they've played. It's, you know, it's a little bit, I mean, that's a great run still, considering the maybe Welsh history of in terms of their football. But based on their recent successes in tournaments and what they've managed to achieve, I think there's an expectation now that they will have runs like that and they will perform.
I mean, when you look at the European rankings at the moment, I'm pretty sure Wales is 12th at the moment. But if you look at who is ahead of them in those rankings, there are actually only two teams, I think, which you could reasonably expect them to catch up and to go in front of, which are Denmark and Switzerland. But apart from that, after that, it seems you're hitting a ceiling for a national team of such a small nation. And I think, you know, they've reached basically the level, the absolute level where, well, I don't think they can get much better, basically.
I don't disagree with you, Philip. I reckon, Flo, you might have to add Wales to Leeds and Jack Grealish for...
Well, no, what I'm saying that they've set their standards higher now. They've achieved so much that the expectation is higher, and they've got a really good set of players. So I think that comes with the territory when you've got, you know, I guess you could call it that, a golden generation. But think of this team of Wales players compared to what we've seen before, when they've got one or two standouts who end up carrying the weight of the team on their shoulders. They don't really have that anymore. It used to be just Bale. Now they've got more depth. And I think in that sense, you expect a bit more of them. And I think some of the performances under Giggs haven't necessarily been that convincing, that impressive. But now it's about pushing on, and it'll be really interesting how they do at the Euros, because of the success they had in the last tournament, the expectations will be pretty high, I think.
All right, that'll do for part one. Part two, we begin with Ireland 0, Bulgaria 0. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Ireland 0, Bulgaria 0. Louis says, did the Ireland-Bulgaria game actually happen? Or did they just agree that a 0-0 is what would have happened and not bothered? Neil says, what is the longest an international team has gone without scoring? I'm inspired to know after that Ireland game. My question to you, Barry, is do you think the next player to score for Ireland has been born yet?
I mean, it should be impossible to be a vaguely competitive, and I use the word competitive in the loosest possible term, but reasonably competitive football team, it should be impossible to go seven games without scoring. At least, you know, a deflection, get a penalty, an own goal, something. But Ireland have pulled it off. So I had the England game on the big telly and the Ireland game on the tablet. Normally it would be the other way around, but I was just so convinced the Ireland game would be terrible that I thought, I can't. I will you know, that will be my secondary game on which I will focus a lesser amount of attention. Again, Stephen Kenny was without 13 of his original squad for various reasons. Another two were diagnosed or tested positive for COVID. There was three players on the team I've literally never heard of before.
Wow, mind you, the bar's low. You don't know anyone who plays for West Brom, so it's all relative.
Ryan Manning, James Collins, not that one, and Ronan Curtis.
Ryan Manning, former QPR left back. Okay. Barry, how could you forget? How could you forget this?
Well, QPR is arguably the team I know even less about than West Brom, because I think the last time I saw them play... Les Ferdinand was up front. But Jason Knight, who's another guy I wasn't particularly familiar with, he played quite well. But they've now gone 11 hours plus without scoring a goal, which it almost makes me want them to not score in their next game, just to see how much gas is or brackets is not in this explosion, as the case may be.
Well, Kian says, do you think that collectively Irish people were awful in a past life? That's why we've been forced to sit through seven games in eight with no goals. I'm calling this at 55 minutes into the match. He sent that message. And this is from Showbox Billy, who says, for Barry, with the rankings as they stand, Ireland pot three could end up in a World Cup qualifying group with Denmark, Wales, Georgia, Cyprus, and bitter rivals, the Faroe Islands. Would Ireland's first World Cup in 20 years be worth the cost of having to play these teams again? Personally, I can't watch it. It makes me doubt reality. For the past 4 or 5 years, it feels like we're always drawing a goal down to Denmark or Wales, or we're praying for Shane Duffy to get something from a stoppage time set piece in a must-win game in Tbilisi.
Yeah, I mean, Macedonia used to be our nemesis, but now it's very much Denmark, Wales and Cyprus.
Barry, do you think that potentially now that the situation has maybe been solved with a new chief executive coming in and that whole, I guess, politically terrible situation that the Irish FA had for so long, that will help things? Or do you think it's just the fact that there isn't talent pathways, football isn't a growing sport?
There is a lot of competition for hearts and minds in Ireland. You know, you've got hurling, you've got Gaelic football, you've got rugby, all competing for kids' attention. And then, of course, you've Xboxes and iPads as well. So I don't know is the simple answer to in turn. But there doesn't seem to be a huge amount of talent coming through. And what talent we do have is all playing for England and playing depressingly well for England.
A bit like Northern Ireland as well. If your main 11 is made up of people that play in the Football League, then relative to who you play in European and world football is going to fall at that level too, right? That's just the reality. So there's not much you can do if your talent pool is playing in the lower divisions and they match up potentially to the top divisions in the rest of Europe, maybe where the strength isn't as big.
Yeah, well, I mean, Michael O'Neill did a great job with Northern Ireland with a very ragbag assortment of players, most of whom were playing in the lower divisions, but it's pretty rare that happens. You know, the Iceland team that qualified for and beat England, they were kind of similar as well. But that doesn't happen very often, does it?
I thought you said they're competing with Xboxes and iPads. And I actually, the idea of Evander Holyfield playing Candy Crush was a big issue for people in Cork. Israel 1, Scotland 0. Lovely goal from Manuel Solomon turned Scott McTominay inside out. Scotland played pretty well, as they did in Slovakia, but they were 4 points clear with 2 games left in the Nations League Group B2. Winning their section would have meant a higher chance of a playoff place for the World Cup, which is how they got through to the Euros, isn't it? So they'll need to finish first or second in their qualifying group. That's all going to be drawn on the 7th of December. Steve Clark said, "We've come a long way in a short time. We shouldn't forget how far we've come, but we know how far we've got to go. If we want to be regularly successful and regularly qualifying for tournaments, we have to go away and home and get good results. Effort and endeavour. You can't fault the players for that in the 2 games, but the little bit of quality was missing when we needed it." Yeah, Lee Griffiths had a chance late on, fluffed his lines when he thought he would get a decent strike. And there was a big claim for a penalty at the end, but not enough for the Scots. Northern Ireland drew 1-1 with Romania, not enough for them to get to avoid relegation to Group C. Now, Spain 6, Germany 0. Germany hadn't lost by 6 goals since 1931. To be fair to them, it was their first defeat in 13 games, but only won 3 of their previous 8, only won once against top-level opposition since the World Cup. They had no shots on target. Philippe, how shocked were you when you saw this scoreline progressing?
Yes, I mean, shocked is the word, because you felt that they have to wake up at some point, don't they? No. Surely they're going to get better? No. Surely they're going to create one chance? No. And you also started to think, well, this is crazy. This is not the Spanish team that we've been talked about, which was supposedly still in the phase of rebuilding and had licked its wounds, but it was only slowly finding back its ways. And to be honest, what I was also thinking is that it's gone long enough. I mean, this is looking, it's like watching a wake for Joachim Löw, and what's been happening since the World Cup, really, is that we don't seem to have in place the kind of system, both in terms of tactics and in terms of the actual, the Mannschaft, the team itself, which is getting the best out of what is still a very fine generation of players, even if it's really struggling to find, you know, as we know, the centre halves to replace Hummels and Boateng, who are still out there in the wild. But no, it felt really like the last wheels coming out of this once beautiful chariot, and that it was time to take the helmsman out. Probably a mixed metaphor.
Well, there could be a helmsman on a cart.
Why not? Absolutely. Yeah. But it was shocking, really. Really shocking.
Yeah, Jogi Löw said, "We departed from our plan. We were running around somewhere. No organisation, no communication. Everything was bad." Mesut Ozil, Arsenal fans, be pleased to know that Mesut Ozil doesn't just tweet about Arsenal games that he's not playing in. He tweeted that it's time to bring back Jerome Boateng. Is it a stupid question to ask, how can Bayern be so... I mean, Kimmich was missing and he's such a key player, right, for Bayern and for Germany. But is it ridiculous to make a comparison between Bayern Munich and Germany?
It's not stupid at all. I mean, the best German players are with Bayern Munich. It's always been the case. And you would say that, in fact, part of the success of... Well, the huge success of this German national team has been quite often to look at what was the model at Bayern and to basically replicate it at a higher level. And it's worked. Like, for example, look at the 2014 side, and you will look at it and you think, well, it reminds me a lot about Heinke's Bayern, for example. So, and you could say, actually, no, it's by going away from the Bayern thing that Löw has met his nemesis. And there are actually many people, I think, in Germany who are saying right now, apart from we've had enough of Joachim Löw, about the fact that this team, this current team, was very much a team in which he tried to put his own imprint, perhaps more than in previous ones. So he got rid of Boateng, he got rid of whom else? He got rid of Thomas Müller, who is also, you know, the glaring absentee from this team. So in a way, he de-Bayerned it. And some people would say that's part of the reason why he has a problem.
Seems strange to de-Bayern anything when Bayern are quite clearly the best team in Europe.
The best team in the world.
I was messaging Archie, who was saying, look, part of the issue is a lot of Germany doesn't really care about the national team right now. That the German equivalent of Bargain Hunt got more viewers than one of the Germany games over the international break was proof of this. I ask whether Jogi Löw would remain coach until the Euros. Oliver Bierhoff, who's the national team director, said, absolutely yes, this game changes nothing. We still trust Jogi Löw. No doubt about that. So what, we give him a couple of days then after that sort of vote of confidence.
Maybe they should get the German equivalent of David Dickinson in to manage Dein Mein.
Yeah, Archie sent me a video of him. He looks like a sort of luxury version of the Doc from Back to the Future. Man City fans...
What does a luxury version of Doc from Back to the Future look like?
It's like the Doc from Back to the Future has been given a makeover that you'd get on Lorraine.
But that's David Dickinson.
That's a very good point.
He's just tanned and coiffed, and that's David Dickinson right there.
Did you see the hotel room Sid had for this game?
Oh, no.
Was it very nice?
Sid was staying in a hotel, which I presumably is part of the stadium in Seville. So the curtains of his hotel room, he opened them and you were basically looking out onto the pitch. You had a perfect view of the whole pitch.
It's like the Reebok Arena in Bolton. Yeah. Love that.
They have that at the Reebok. I think they have it at the London Stadium as well, I think. City fans should be excited about Ferran Torres. I didn't know a whole lot about him until they signed him, but his hat-trick... He took all his goals really nicely, didn't he? He's a lovely player. I enjoyed Lars Sivertsen's thread on the Norwegian B team going from from the weekend, which began, the Norwegian FA are having to call up a new squad of entirely foreign-based players who weren't in the initial squad so that Wednesday's game against Austria can go ahead a bit later. The Norwegian non-quarantining, non-Norway-based ad hoc banter squad has been confirmed. Veton Berisha is based in Norway, but can go because he had COVID fairly recently. 14 of the 18 uncapped. A couple of days later, 17 of the 18 arrived in Vienna yesterday. Goalkeeper Per Christian Bravett had an inconclusive test, had to be retested and flown down on private jet this afternoon. Should be a very odd match this evening. Norway 1-0 up after a goal from Gaius Zahid of Apoel Nicosia. And then it goes on 1-1 in the end. Late equaliser a bit harsh on the Norwegian reserves, who put in a fine shift. Several players will feel they did enough to be involved with the full squad next time around. That concludes a very, very odd bit of international football. Thank you, Lars. All that means, though, Philippe, the Nations League final is actually pretty tantalising, isn't it?
Yeah.
Belgium, France, Italy and Spain.
Yeah, I know. In October 6th to the 10th of October 2021, we already know the semi-finals. Because it's straight semi-finals, France-Spain, and Belgium against a resurgent and quite exciting Italian side. So yes, actually, the final tournament might be, if we're still around, it might be a wonderful occasion.
Oh, don't say that.
Well, I don't know. I
mean, we've got Euros to get through first. I can't even think that far ahead.
And the Club World Cup.
Oh, who could forget?
Yes.
Philippe, do you mean like if we're still around, as in, will the pod still be around, or as in there'll be an apocalypse and we'll all be dead?
In every sense of the word, Max, in every sense of the word.
Fine. It's interesting the Nations League final is four completely different sides. It was England, Holland, Portugal, Switzerland last time. I mean, it shows there are a lot of quite good teams in Europe. Giroud is closing in on Thierry Henry's record for France. How do you feel about that?
I feel very happy for Olivier Giroud. I feel very happy that the people who've been saying things about him, that let's stay polite, can now shut up. Because he's been on the receiving end of completely uncalled for criticism and worse for a while, because he's perceived to be the teacher's pet of Didier Deschamps. And it's true that since Didier Deschamps has taken over the French national team, I don't think that any player has played more than Olivier Giroud. But there's a reason for that, is because he's actually scored 44 goals for the national team, which is 14 more than Alan Shearer scored for England. So he mustn't be that bad to be at this kind of level. And the goals were excellent. And again, I think that the way he teamed up with Griezmann was, again, very, very encouraging. It's amazing, isn't it, that you've got a player who doesn't play for Chelsea teaming up with a player who doesn't play for for Barcelona. And they were fresh. They haven't played.
but the interesting about Giroud is, mm-hmm. like, he's not starting for Chelsea. He's probably behind, what, Werner and Abraham for Chelsea. But he's still, you know, he's getting on occasionally. But then if you think about, like, what Premier League team would he have to go to be a guaranteed starter? Because I looked at it yesterday and I was thinking, I mean, perhaps Southampton, but it'd be harsh on... I mean, he wouldn't get in ahead of Ings, but maybe you play him instead of Che Adams, right? I don't know. Crystal Palace?
It's because of the type of player. It's not because of the talent of the player. It's because of the style of the player. And the fact also people have got a perception of him because he's such a huge player that he's somehow... Well, he's not the quickest. He's actually a bit slow for a centre-forward, to say the least. But... he's also a very subtle, technically correct, and actually more than that, type of centre forward who loves to play one-touch football. And you have to think of teams which would actually fit in with this kind of thing, and perhaps football being more and more dynamic and more energy-based and quick transitions and quick this and quick that is not immediately the kind of player that you would think of. The difference is that the international game, you do not have quite the same dynamism energy. You do not have it. You will never see a national team play like Bayern did in the Champions League final. So France has got a pragmatic setup, which is a bit slowish, but really works well with some super players. And in this kind of setup, is God's gift, honestly. It's wonderful. And he keeps his place on merit when you think about the players who could actually come in and play this role. That's pretty amazing. And there's another one, by the way, coming in, who is not a centre-forward, but who's an attacking player, but who's absolutely been wonderful throughout this international break. It's Marcus Thuram. I have to give his name. You know, Lilian Thuram's son, who plays for Borussia Mönchengladbach. And have a look at what he did in the win over Sweden. Look at the highlights. There is one sequence of play which actually leads to a goal, which is rather, it's mesmeric. No other word for it. Yet another one to add to the list. When goalkeepers go up front to try and score for their team in the 92nd minute, and you always think, well, what if the team the corner is against gets the ball and scores in an empty goal? It happened.
And was it because the best part of that is goalkeeper who's not used to sprinting 100 metres having to sprint 100 metres.
Actually, I think Olsen at one point just looked back and went, oh shit, and stopped. Because it was Kingsley Coman, and Kingsley scored. And he took his time. He scored from only 35 yards. He could probably have scored from 50.
Did I see that Olivier Giroud or his people have been engaging in their now traditional international break? Oh, he's going to have to move somewhere in January to get first team football, when that doesn't appear to be the case.
Deschamps keeps saying that his players have to have some first-team action with their clubs if they want to be considered, which is one of the reasons why, by the way, Olivier Giroud left Arsenal to start with, because he wanted to have game time. I don't think in his case that he needs to worry too much about it. But, you know, yes, you can understand why, with the competition he's got at Chelsea, he might look at another club.
On that subject, Baz, Miguel Almiron's agent told a radio station in Paraguay that Almiron would have left if it hadn't been for COVID, and he wants to go somewhere where the team have the ball and do some attacking and once again not realizing that that might get back, or completely realizing that it might get back to this country. Right, that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll look ahead to the Premier League and do any other business. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's touch on the AFCON qualifications games. Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang has slammed the Confederation of Africa, CAF, after being made to feel like a, quote, hostage. The Arsenal captain and his Gabon teammates had to sleep in an airport ahead of their qualifier against Gambia. Just before 6 a.m, they were allowed into the country, just 10 hours before kickoff. He said, in 2020, we want Africa to grow, and this is not how we're going to get there. I mean, they lost 2-1. Meanwhile, Tunisia were given a dressing room with no electricity, and Dar es Salaam in Tanzania had to get kitted up using torches from their mobile phones. The game finished 1-1. It's ridiculous, right?
It is utterly ridiculous. And the situation, I mean, it's been brewing up to come to that. At continental level, African football is in the right mess at the moment. And I mean, when I mean in the right mess, I don't think I can think of any a situation being as serious as that before. The World Cup qualifiers have been played in very, very strange circumstances. There have been some wonderful moments in them. I mean, for anybody who hasn't seen the goal that Riyad Mahrez, for example, scored against Zimbabwe in Harare, that it's just, Max, come on, describe it.
It's a sort of a long ball. It's almost a pass, sort of like a De Boer to Bergkamp, but a bit further out, right? And Mahrez controls it with a kind of volleyed back heel. It's not a scorpion kick, but it's kind of a volleyed back heel, which brings it perfect into his path. And then he sort of just mazy dribbles and sits about five players down and scores. But the other first touch we haven't mentioned yet that I wanted to is Phil Foden's kind of Cruyff turn, half volley control out of the sky, which was something quite ridiculous. I tweeted Foden is like Jack Grealish on acid, and then realised I'd never taken acid, so I don't know if that was a good analogy or not. Most people replying said actually it probably wasn't. But yeah, the Mahrez goal. I hope I've described it well enough, Philippe.
I think it was a very, very fine attempt. Now this piece of skill he did, we have a word for it in French, which is called aile de pigeon, pigeon's wing, which describes the way that the leg is sort of braced to bring the ball. And the thing is, he looked so much in control of absolutely everything. It's absolutely glorious. But unfortunately, on the rest of the continent, the situation was not great. And you've mentioned those two games. There have been other incidents games which honestly shouldn't have taken place. And in which states on some absolutely awful pitches and so on and so on. And the problem is that it is in a state of turmoil at the moment. There is a power vacuum. The elections, presidential election of CAF, are in March 2021. There are already 5 candidates. It's an absolute mess. The current chairman, president of CAF, Ahmed Ahmad from Madagascar, is being interviewed, so to speak, by the judgment chamber of FIFA Ethics Committee tomorrow. CAF was in a very good financial situation not that long ago. They had signed a deal with the Lagardère Media Group for $1 billion. I won't go into details, but basically the deal, they decided finally to say, no, we don't want to have that in the end. We'll go another way. But so basically the money hasn't been coming in as it used to. So they have found themselves with the task of actually financing the broadcasting of the games which are taking place currently, which is just like money thrown in the sea. Millions and millions and millions. It is mad. And this is what we are now. And so I think all of us who love African football feel really, really sorry about what's happening at the moment. We only hope for one thing, that those elections come very quickly in March 2021. There is a good guy who is put in charge of the Confederation, and African football can start putting its house in order. Because everything you see, the story about what happened in Banjul for the Gabon team, what happened in Dar es Salaam for the Tunisian team, all of this is part of the same systemic failures that have been plaguing, that are plaguing African football at the moment. With, of course, you add a big dash of COVID on top of that, and you've got a perfect storm of awfulness, and it's very, very sad.
Flo, yesterday I saw Arsenal were playing Tottenham in the Continental Cup, and Arsenal went through on penalties, Alex Morgan missing the decisive penalty, and then Arsenal went out, which I didn't understand. Could you explain that to me?
It's the Continental Cup is a bit of a unloved tournament that I think needs a bit of a refresh, but essentially it's the League Cup in the women's game, but it's group stages. Don't ask me why they came up with that. It's a tournament that hasn't been around very long. I think the first edition was in 2011, so it's a fairly new competition that they created. It only involves WSL and second tier championship teams, and it's now regionalized, which means that you play teams in and around where you are. So for Arsenal, that means playing Chelsea. It means playing Spurs, who aren't very good, and other London teams. And for the likes of Man United, it means playing Liverpool and Everton. But this year, it's been a bit complicated because two games last night were cancelled because of COVID. A game last week was cancelled because of a separate issue to do with the stadium not being ready. So it's been a bit of a chaotic situation. And the games aren't also, well, only a select number of games are shown because it's up to the clubs basically to decide if they want to show the game. So actually no one could watch that Arsenal game against Spurs, which is, you know, obviously a North London derby, but everyone was just sort of following it on Twitter. So yeah, it's all a bit of a mess really, that competition, and it's sort of unloved and needs a bit of a refresh. But lots of fans, you know, still want to watch their team, so it's just a shame. And it was also Leah Williamson's 150th appearance last night, and a lot of fans were obviously disappointed because she's only, I think, 23 years old, and she's already got 150 appearances for Arsenal. She's going to be a massive part of England going forward. And fans were really disappointed that they didn't get to watch that game. And Arsenal have had a lot of success in this competition, so it's obviously disappointing they got knocked out as well. But yeah, the Conti Cup's a funny one. It's a funny old competition.
You mentioned, players getting COVID, and that is the number of footballers getting COVID, I think, with the international break as well, is 16 positive cases is an all-time record, I think. 99 players injured as well, Philippe. I know you've been tweeting about this. And that sort of linked, I guess, to, you know, the EFL have increased number of substitutes to 5. All the top leagues have 5, except for the Premier League. And it is the clubs that make that decision. And if the decision is going to be reversed, it will be the clubs who do it.
I mean, it is to be welcome. I mean, this decision, and it's hoped that the sim would be adopted across the board. But one, talking to a few people who are, you know, specialists in this type of work, they're not sure that this will be more than the plaster on a wooden leg, basically, because the big problem is that there has been no pre-season. And I know people always answer that as saying, well, there were about 4 weeks between. That's not a pre-season. That's not a pre-season. The biorhythms of the player have been completely, messed up with since Project Restart. And Project Restart was hyper-protected and perhaps done in a bit more rational way than what we are seeing now. And what we're seeing now is, I think, clubs in England, Premier League clubs, which are also taking part in European competitions, will not have had a single break of more than 3 or 4 days from the beginning of the seasons to the 6th of January. That's insane. And it doesn't matter if you've got 5 subs or 3 subs. When you haven't had a pre-season, and they haven't had a pre-season, they've just had a bit of rest, but their bodies are all over the place, and which is why we're seeing all these injuries. And I don't know what to say, because I don't think there is any solution which you can adopt right now, apart from the fact we might have to see managers doing with their clubs what the Norwegians had to do with their national team, which is like, oh, let's have completely different set of players this week. But the problem is that it is not something, what you would need is a proper break at some point. And I don't think we're going to get it, Max. In 2020, 2020, 2021. We're not going to get this break. The winter break is gone.
I think it's interesting that more coaches didn't do some forward planning and perhaps bring in and spend a bit more money. Obviously, I know we're in the middle of the pandemic, so financially a lot of clubs are struggling, but a lot of clubs are willing to put big amounts of money on one player. But I don't understand why there wasn't more foresight to bring in more squad players, cheaper, more experienced squad players, because now what's happening is clubs are just dipping into their academies. And I think it's obviously good for player development, but at the same time, when the biggest club like Liverpool is sort of rummaging around for some young players that might be able to work and throwing them into the deep end, I just think it's surprising that more of them didn't think, should we buy a couple of sort of 5 to 10 million guys who can just be in and around the squad? Because looking ahead to this season, the situation with COVID, it's going to be mad. And I just don't understand why those that had the means didn't do that.
A bit like a sort of, you know, like, old goalkeepers are just the third keeper. Just get some old centre-backs who sort of clog around and then just turn up. I mean, I agree.
Well, exactly, right? I don't know. It just seems weird if because some of these clubs have got loads of money they're willing to throw about. So I don't understand why Moore didn't think about it in that way. But, I mean, obviously, you know, that hindsight's a wonderful thing and perhaps they didn't realise it was going to get this bad.
Also, Barry's idea is a bit like running a Saturday team where you just get a text from Chapman saying, I'm going to Dubai for 2 weeks. I'm not around. And you have to deal with it. Anyway, Liverpool, who are injury hit, play Leicester. And that's given Liverpool's, you know, it's not the right reason to find this game more interesting. But it in a way, it makes it more interesting that, you know, as Tunji says, Jamie Vardy to end Liverpool's Anfield unbeaten run. Can anyone make that bold prediction, Baz? I mean, they've got a chance, haven't they?
Oh, it's a very good chance, I would say. There are some mouth-watering fixtures this weekend, and whether it's full-strength teams or the lame and the halt lining up as best they can, but I would give Leicester a very good chance of prevailing in that game. They may not, but they'd be going there with a lot of confidence, you'd imagine.
Spurs City is an exciting game. Leeds Arsenal as well. Newcastle Chelsea. Villa Brighton, Man United, West Brom, Fulham, Everton, Sheffield United, West Ham. We'll talk about them all on Monday.
You've left out the most important one. Like I've now realised I Google the weekend fixtures every Thursday, and I immediately go to see who's in the graveyard slot of 5:30 on a Monday. So this
week, yes,
Burnley Crystal Palace. Poor old Burnley.
Of course it is. Can we talk about Mario Balotelli to Barnsley for 1 second? They've made an inquiry. You're the EFL expert here, Flo. Would Balotelli fit in at Oakwell?
You know what? I would love to see him just in Barnsley, in the city, or is it a city town of Barnsley? Just because I think it'd be great to see him hanging out there. Would he fit in? I mean, they've got a fairly well-functioning forward in Woodrow, so I think he's a little bit surplus to requirements. But why not? Sounds fun.
Imagine 5 years ago saying Mario Balotelli is surplus to requirements at Barnsley. It's so disappointing for him.
That's the way it is. That's the way it is, Max. So sorry.
While we're on lower league, it's worth noting that Ryan Reynolds and Rob McElhenney are to be the new owners of National League club Wrexham. The Wrexham Supporters Trust members voted overwhelmingly to back the takeover. 98.6% of those who responded backed the bid. The Trust wished the pair the very best of luck in charge and look forward to what the future brings. Just a tremendously fun story. And we shouldn't just get excited because they're Hollywood stars, right? You know, they've got to do it well. But it seems to be that their ambitions to make Wrexham be successful will be good for Wrexham because Wrexham will become successful. Flo, your hand is up.
Yeah, my hand is up because I think it's really interesting because it's a style of ownership that is becoming really popular in American sports. Matthew McConaughey's got a stake in Austin FC, the new MLS team. They just launched their kit yesterday and did a sparkly new launch video. We've got Angel City FC and new NWSL team who are owned by Serena Williams, Natalie Portman, about a billion other famous people who, you know, Eva Longoria, host of Hollywood names. And I think it's an investment sort of style that we've seen a lot in the US. And I think it's interesting bringing it to the UK. What I think is not concerning, but what we see in football over here is you don't see famous people owning football clubs, because if you're a Hollywood star, unfortunately, in the Football League especially, maybe different in Wrexham because the budgets are much lower at the moment, but you don't actually have enough money to keep some of these clubs afloat, because it requires silly money, very silly money. It's men with big egos and too much money, and more money than sense, who want to own football clubs, because they can just chuck money down the drain and then eventually they get bored and they're like, see you later. Whereas Hollywood money, even though these people are really rich, it's not quite the levels of some of those big, crazy, multi-billionaires who, you know, own massive global companies or even countries. So it's just interesting how that's going to work and how they're going to invest, what is it, the 2 million that they've said they're going to do. I think the great thing is, it's a small project, and they're not coming into an established EFL club thinking that they're going to be able to take them to the Premier League. I think they're being realistic. I've read their mission statement. I think it's really great. They've noticed, you know, that that Wrexham needs a lot of support, and that football is such a big part of that place. And I really appreciate that. So I'm really excited to see what they're going to do. I just hope there's some realistic and long-term ambition, and they're not going to mess them around, basically, because it's, you know, it requires a lot of money to run a football club, unfortunately.
But isn't that the amount of money they need, or they will put in? Isn't that the amount of money they will get from Netflix for the series?
Is it exactly the same amount?
It's when you work it out. I mean, I've talked to one person in the industry, documentary industry, who said, yes, I mean, this kind of 300 grand per episode is about right for this type of content. So it could be that if you look at it from a business side, a point of view, if you know you're going to go to one of the big new platforms and be able to sell your documentary for this amount of money, in fact, you're not putting a single penny from your own pocket.
But then what about when the series is over?
That's a very good question.
It's sort of the equivalent of a Hollywood A-lister going to do an ad in Japan for chewing gum or something. If they end up looking ridiculous, nobody really knows, because it's in Japan. And it will be the same if it all goes horribly pear-shaped in Wrexham for Ryan and Rob.
Let's hope it doesn't.
Well, I'm just hoping they turn out to be a pair of tyrants, and that someone will do a bit of digging and find out they're responsible for lots of human rights abuses just to make Newcastle fans really upset.
I hope that they are absolutely wedded to long ball football, and they bring in Allardyce,
the team,
then Pulis, then Beck. That's what they want is 4-4-2, big man, little man up front, and just anybody who tries to get the ball down, they sell them immediately. Look, that's plenty for today. Sorry to Max, who asked the question, would you rather give up eating cheese or pigs? And Michael, who asked, who's the most famous toad? Lockdown and international break really had effect on listener questions this week. Anyway, we'll be back on Monday with the Premier League flow. Thank you.
Thank you, Max.
Thank you, Barry.
You're welcome.
Cheers, Philippe.
Thank you.
See you Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.